Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Anderle. This hour on the program, these are difficult times for many of us here in America. We've suffered economic loss. Some of us have lost retirement savings. Some of us have lost our jobs. Our standard of living has been abridged, to say the least, for some of us. And around the world, some of the news is not so good. There's fighting and killing in a number of conflicts, American soldiers risking their lives daily, so times are not easy. What do some of the world's great philosophers have to say about coping with life in difficult times? Can we be happy and peaceful in a world that is chaotic, in a personal world where we may be suffering deprivation, maybe for some of us extreme deprivation? Wisdom from philosophy this hour. Back with us, Tom Morris was for 15 years professor of philosophy at the University of Notre Dame. He's now chairman of the Morris Institute for Human Values. You can read his blogs at morrisinstitute.com and at Huffington Post. Among Tom's books, The Stoic Art of Living and The Art of Achievement. Tom Morris, welcome back to the show.
That's great to be with you, Fred.
And we're at 614-292-8513. You can email comments or questions to openline@wosu.org. Well, Tom, in one of your at morrisinstitute.com, in one of your essays, you quoted Nietzsche, who wrote the following about difficulty and achievement. He said, "Examine the lives of the best and most fruitful people and ask yourselves whether a tree that is supposed to grow to a proud height can dispense with bad weather and storms, whether misfortune and external resistance, some kinds of hatred, jealousy, stubbornness, mistrust, hardness, avarice, and violence do not belong among the favorable conditions without which any great growth, even of virtue, is scarcely possible." So we need some hardship in order to grow, huh?
Yeah, it's one of the wonderful ironies of life, isn't it? I mean, there's this remarkable book written by an elderly lady years ago. Florida Scott Maxwell is her name. And she said, "The things about my life I have regretted the most, that have been the most difficult, have ironically given birth in my soul the qualities I most admire." And, you know, it's one of the Stoic philosophers said, "A boxer who has not been bloodied and bruised in the ring can never have the confidence that only that will bring." It is interesting how dealing with hardships, dealing with difficulties, as hard as they are to go through, they almost always somehow deepen us or strengthen us.
I wonder why that is, because somebody could make an argument to say, well, you know, if you go through sufficient difficulties, they may weaken you. You may wind up, you know, in worse shape spiritually, emotionally than when you started out.
You know, sometimes that does happen. It's ultimately up to us. I mean, this was a theme in ancient philosophy. Hardly anything in the world has an intrinsic value, positive or negative. It's usually up to us what we do with it. And that can be applied to difficulties. You know, do we respond well or badly? Difficulties, hardships can weaken people. They can make people bitter, surly, very negative. They can make people lash out at others. It's interesting to me that the things that we have come into our lives unexpectedly, sometimes our first reaction is not our best reaction. Mm-hmm. We have to calm down a bit first. In fact, that's one of the pieces of advice the great philosophers have typically agreed in. They've said, don't rush to judgment. When something really bad seeming comes into your life, don't rush to judgment. Hardly anything in this world is as good as it seems or as bad as it seems at first. So we should all just calm down, and we're put in a better position to actually use the difficulty to deepen ourselves rather than letting it, you know, batter us and beat us up.
Mm-hmm. Do they ever give examples of something that might come into our life that we might first greet as something pretty negative and then say, well, wait a minute, if I think about this in another way, this is to my psychological advantage?
Oh, yeah. We find examples of that all through history. In fact, let me mention to you one. I just heard a winemaker out in California saying recently that if the grapes get, you know, plenty of sunshine and plenty of water, it's going to make for pretty terrible wine. That you've actually got to almost starve the grapes. You've got to push them to their very brink of survival to get great wine. And I've always loved that metaphor for human life. And, you know, the philosophers Nietzsche and many others have used those kind of organic examples from nature to show how, you know, what seems to be, you know, take Nietzsche and the storms. Look at all the noise and the fearful appearances of the storms. Well, necessary for the hardihood and sturdiness of the oak.
Mm-hmm. You know, this is not necessarily advice that we want to hear in a certain way. You know, I mean, you know, but nonetheless, I mean, I think generally true. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's so many of the philosophers of the ancient world, especially. They had a kind of an art of change that they developed over time, how to deal with difficult changes. And first and foremost is what I like to call the art of self-control, and it consists in not rushing to judgment. Okay, first of all, don't rush to judgment. Secondly, value the right things, because sometimes we get really upset by a change because we're valuing the wrong things, and we're totally needlessly depressed mm-hmm. or alarmed. I think a lot of people are going through that right now. They've had a certain form of attachment to a certain level of material luxury and convenience that they valued too much in their lives. And so now they're overreacting to the threats the current economy poses to those things.
Mm-hmm.
If they valued the right things, they'd probably be able to take all this a little bit better.
You quote the philosopher Marcus Aurelius, his three disciplines, and the second one is the discipline of desire, in which he says very little is actually necessary for a happy life.
Absolutely. I think most of us who are enjoying material success in life, we can look back at a time when we were what we would consider now very poor, and yet we were just as happy as we have been in much greater material comfort. Some of the philosophers recommended go sleep on a hard floor once a month, eat bread, drink water, and you will discover how little it takes to live a good life.
Mm-hmm. There have been studies, I guess, of happiness. You know, people have subjected happiness to study, which I think is very difficult in terms of quantifying it. But in general, the studies seem to agree that past a certain level of income, mm-hmm. a level that, you know, sustains our basic health and life, that having more money and more material possessions, people do not self-report that they are happier.
That's right, and that research has been widely disseminated for quite a while, and yet it doesn't really seem to make a dent in people's ambitions and motivations. You talk to a wide swath of people, as I do on a regular basis, you find how much of ambition these days tends to be based on the contrary assumption, that if I can just have a big enough house, a nice enough car, membership in a great country club, or whatever it happens to be. You know, at different levels of income, people do aspire to whatever is the next level up, thinking that's going to make all the difference in their experience of life, and it really doesn't.
Mm-hmm. Did Marcus Aurelius go on to elaborate his second discipline of desire there? What did he say further about very little being actually necessary?
Well, Marcus Aurelius was really big on controlling our thoughts. Mm-hmm. In fact, the three great Roman Stoics, Seneca, Epictetus, and Marcus Aurelius, really basically agreed on this, that the thoughts that come to us spontaneously aren't necessarily the best thoughts for us to have. We can have thoughts of envy, thoughts of admiration, or thoughts of jealousy, thoughts of hankering after certain things we see, things that delight the eyes, as the ancients would say. And the Stoics really insisted we impose a discipline on our thinking. I mean, typically, most of us think of the concept of discipline in connection with action.
Sure.
And especially in connection with the action of young children. We're trying to encourage certain kinds of behaviors and discourage others, so we discipline children. But the notion of self-discipline and the notion of self-discipline as applied not only to our behaviors, you know, don't drink too much, don't drink and drive, things like that, but a discipline as applied to our thoughts is a fairly rare concept in the modern world today, and yet it was pervasive amongst the philosophers in the ancient world. Our actions arise out of our thoughts, so if we want to control our actions, we should control our thoughts. And it's hard to control our thoughts if we're not controlling our desires and our emotions. So that's why you have these three disciplines from Marcus. The great commentator Pierre Hadot called them the discipline of thought, the discipline of desire, and the discipline of action. They've got to really be thought of together, because if you control the way you think and you try to control your cravings and hankerings for things, it's going to be much easier to control the way you behave.
Sure.
And to do the things that are actually in your own self-interest over the long run.
Tim, can you give me an example of controlling a thought? How do you go about doing that?
Well, it's funny. The Stoics often gave examples like this. If you if someone has done something that you think was insulting to you, or someone you think has acted contrary to your interest intentionally, then you find anger welling up within you, and you can easily begin to imagine this person, you know, plotting to harm you. And Epictetus, Marcus Aurelius, they would say, just stop it. Stop that thought. Notice it. Pay attention to it. We don't attend enough to the stream of consciousness that really governs our lives for the most part. Attend to the thought and reject it. Consciously reject it. Make yourself think about something else. It could be that person didn't intend to harm you at all. It could be that what they did do intentionally, as a matter of fact, doesn't harm you. There are all these possibilities that we need to think through. And the Stoics said, don't let the emotions that immediately arise within you dictate the thoughts that you have in your mind. Because you can see there could be a very negative cycle going on here. The wrong emotions eliciting the wrong thoughts, which then, you know, support and increase the wrong emotions, which lead to wrong actions. So the Stoics said, get involved consciously in saying, I won't go there.
So first of all, notice the thought. Notice what your thoughts
are
saying. Secondly, in some cases, simply stop the thought and change and divert your attention to something else.
And you can do that.
And you can do that, yeah.
We almost think we can't do that, that we have control, conscious, free control over external actions. I can pick up a pen on my desk, or I can refrain from doing that. But we have control with respect to our thoughts, too. Like anything, it's a skilled behavior. You can become better at it as you try to do it.
I'm thinking of the process of anger that I've experienced. If I indulge in thoughts of anger, they become more elaborate with revenge fantasies.
Revenge fantasies, right? That person who cut you off or who gave you a manual sign as they passed by you. You can imagine yourself, you know, lobbing a grenade into the car.
Sure.
I mean, it's amazing how our imaginations can take over and go places that we never would go in reality.
And of course, then with those kinds of revenge fantasies, which I'll bet we've all have. I've certainly had them. And of course, then your anger increases.
That's right.
And you're not at a very peaceful state of mind at that point.
That's right. Well, and you may not be end up lobbing a grenade into a passing car, but you may end up doing something you would later regret.
Mm-hmm. You may end up in action, or even if it doesn't end up in action, of course, you're quite disturbed at that point.
And you're harming yourself at that point, too. Mm-hmm. You have not only you've taken the action of another person, and you've turned it into something that's capable of harming you in terms of your own physiology. I mean, it's amazing. Seneca wrote an entire series, long series of essays on anger. And as Aristotle said, there's nothing intrinsically wrong with it. It can motivate you to deal with injustice. But with anger, it's always a matter of how much, toward whom, for what reason, for how long, and to what purpose.
Mm-hmm.
We have to ask ourselves these questions, you know, and you can have inappropriate anger, you can have appropriate anger. But when it gets out of control, when it becomes inappropriate, it becomes very harmful for us. And that's the terrible irony of it, is these revenge fantasies aim at the imaginary harm of another person. Meanwhile, we're affecting our own, you know, cardiovascular system, and mm-hmm. and in so many other ways, we're doing harm to ourselves.
Blood pressure could go way up,
absolutely,
for example. And so it can turn from anger to what we might call rage.
Absolutely right. And so we understand the medical processes now in a way they weren't understood in the ancient world, but all the connections were understood in the ancient world. We were warned against these emotions like anger all the time, because they can be very damaging, they can be very dangerous, and that's why we need a discipline of thought, a discipline of desire, a discipline of action. We need to really be monitoring our own behaviors internally and externally to become the kind of people we really want to be.
Philosopher Tom Morris with us, professor of philosophy at the University of Notre Dame for 15 years now, chairman of the Morris Institute for Human Values at morrisinstitute.com. Among Tom's books, The Stoic Art of Living and The Art of Achievement. If this sounds familiar to you, 614-292-8513. You can email comments or questions to openline@wosu.org. Tom, it sounds like the Stoics are saying, when you have a thought, of course, you can stop that thought and divert it. But before you stop it, of course, obviously we must notice it. But secondly, then analyze it to suggest, is this a thought that is harmful to me or others? Or is it a productive thought?
Right. Absolutely right. Attention is the first thing. And as a matter of fact, all the great world's wisdom traditions, religions and philosophies have focused on the question of what do we pay attention to. We're building up an inner structure of value every minute of the day by what we pay attention to. And then we have to know what to do with it. Once we notice we have a certain thought, then that's where the analysis comes in. You know, is this based on reality? Is this accurate? Is this based on fantasy? Is this good for me? Is this harmful to me? Once we start asking these questions, just in the mere asking of the questions, we can begin to calm the emotion down. Because you see, in doing an analysis like that, you have shifted from mostly feeling to mostly thinking. Mm-hmm. And you can actually slow the momentum of that emotion that would otherwise sort of take you over.
So if somebody cuts me off in traffic, or if somebody approaches me and says something angrily to me, I can ask all kinds of questions about that to myself before responding. I mean, did this person, am I really the target? This person has said this angry thing, or are they upset with themselves? Can this person's angry expression really hurt me? And if it can't, do I really need to come back with an angry rejoinder? I mean, et cetera, et cetera. So and those questions, I imagine you could ask yourself fairly quickly.
That's right. And even when you don't have time to go into any inner detail like this, the mere fact that you exercise such analysis when you can makes you more reticent to allow negative emotions to take you over in situations where you don't have the luxury of standing and analyzing for a moment before you respond. In other words, you have begun to change yourself, to make yourself a calmer person, a person less likely to rush to judgment, a person more likely to transcend the immediacy of the situation. I mean, we've all had situations where somebody comes up to us and they're just in a tizzy. They're angry. They're infuriated. And we can feel our own pulse go up before we even know what's going on. And so we can be affected by other people's, you know, physiology, by other people's, and we have to learn to put ourselves into a position to deal with that, because, you know, so much of the stock market recently, we've been hearing this in every kind of news medium, people analyzing so much of the ups and downs of the market as just sheer emotion. You know, just sheer fear. We need more confidence in the market, everybody's saying, but nobody's saying how to get that, but just everybody seems to know we need it. But that just goes to show emotions aren't a matter of just family dynamics and driving on busy highways, but it affects people's lives and livelihoods when it affects the stock market the way it has been.
Surely. To our phones now, and Kelly joins us. Hello, Kelly.
Hi, good morning, Fred. I was just driving down the road, and I pulled off the road so I can talk to you.
But good.
I just was coming back from a yoga class I've been enrolled in for about 6 months now.
Wow.
Before that, had been involved with some other yoga teachers, but this yoga class is focused on breath control, particularly, and the use of mantras. And it's astounding to me how much control you can establish over your thinking and your feelings through the use of yoga.
Absolutely right. Kelly, that's a very important point to make. This doesn't dealing with difficulties doesn't have to start off in the mind. It can start off with you trying to relax your body, because that's one thing that happens to us. We tense up. If you can control your breathing, if you can, it sounds silly, but I do what people call smile therapy. I will just smile at myself in the mirror, and, you know, we know now that releases certain brain chemicals that lift your spirits. Well, the practice of yoga can just put you into a better mind-body posture deal with any difficulty that comes your way.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed, and it also helps you to recognize and to pay attention to the fact that your mind and body are not one and the same.
Mm-hmm.
That you have the capacity of choice with respect to not only how you breathe, but also how you respond to the world around you.
Absolutely right.
That's a good way of putting it, Kelly, that you have the capacity of choice. Because if we don't understand that we have that, we can react automatically. And
Exactly.
Well, thanks so much.
Thank you, Fred.
Yeah, that capacity of choice that Kelly talks about is important. Huh? And Tom, it sounds like, in terms of what the Stoics are saying, we're developing certain habits of mind. I mean, we probably
right.
have unconscious habits that are out of control. We don't
right.
know what
we all do. That's yeah. right. We all have habits. And are they healthy or not is a question we need to ask.
Mm-hmm. And by understanding, well, Marcus Aurelius in the three disciplines, the discipline of thought, your life is what your thoughts make it. By understanding that first principle, then subjecting our thoughts to analysis and control, we gain more control over our lives in terms of being maybe happier.
That's right.
Now again, Marcus Aurelius said very little is actually necessary for a happy life, so he encourages us to examine our desires for material goods. But what do the philosophers say, the ancient philosophers say, about someone who simply doesn't have even the material goods for sufficient food on the table, sufficient shelter?
Sure.
How do they approach that?
There was a bit of debate about that in the ancient world, because one end of the spectrum was the Cynic philosophers like Diogenes, who is said to have lived in an earthen tub. He said he has the most who is most content with the least, so he gave away all his possessions, lived in a borrowed earthen tub, and had a cup for drinking water. And the story is told that one day he saw a slave boy drink out of cupped hands, and so he gave away his cup.
Hmm.
He was admired by Alexander the Great. He was admired by so many people of his time. Of course, he irritated a lot of other people, too, because, you know, he's the guy who was walking around with a lighted lamp during the daytime and, when asked what he was doing, said, looking for an honest man.
he actually did this.
Yes, he would have been burning the midnight oil a lot recently in Wall Street.
Yeah.
But Diogenes believed in that you could live so modestly, so meagerly, that it's almost beyond what most of us are capable of imagining. None of the philosophers would want to see starvation, would want to see disease, would want to see people suffer. Some of the philosophers, though, like Diogenes, believe that most of our suffering is self-imposed, that pain is one thing, physical pain is one thing, but a lot of the suffering is just how we interpret our circumstances, how we interpret our pain. And, of course, that could never be used as a social hammer to kind of knock away any public policy that would help people deal with problems like homelessness and poverty. I think philosophers like Diogenes were just counseling us individually
mm-hmm.
to consider that if we think we're living in a minimal way, we might even need to reconsider that, because it could be that, you know, and as Americans, we're famous for using up a really disproportionate share of the world's resources. And now people are being called to rethink all that by the economic necessity, like the administration has been saying, you know, a good crisis should never go to waste. A lot of people are philosophizing anew about how much of our lifestyle and our lifestyle assumptions have put us in a position where this economic catastrophe could arise in the first place mm-hmm. and then touch us so deeply in the second place.
Tom Morris, The Stoic Art of Living and The Art of Achievement, among Tom's books. We're going to take a break here, then call us, hang on the line. We'll be back with my guest and you after these messages at WOSU 820 NPR News.
Remember back in November when Norm Coleman was
humbled and grateful for the victory that the voters gave us last night?
I'll bet he doesn't either. I'm Neil Conan, political junkie Ken Rudin on the Minnesota Senate, a congressional race in Illinois, and, of course, a trivia question. Plus, Murray Horowitz on the movies that celebrate the wisdom and courage of the common man, The Grapes of Wrath. Next, Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation begins later this afternoon. It starts at 2 o'clock right here on WOSU 820 and NPR News. This month on WOSU-TV, watch a new groundbreaking four-part series traveling through time and terrain to uncover the depth of the Appalachian story. Watch Appalachia, A History of Mountains and People, airing this month, Thursday nights at 10 on WOSU-TV. Again, that program is on Thursday nights at 10 on WOSU-TV. And taking a look at the weather forecast, the freeze warning from this morning has expired and temperatures are warming up. It's currently 39 degrees in downtown Columbus. Sunshine today with a high right around 55. Clouds this evening and skies will start to clear overnight, a low of 34. Mostly sunny for Thursday and a high of 62. For Friday, scattered rain showers and a high of 54. You're listening to Open Line on WOSU 820 NPR News. Thanks for joining us. And now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. We're finding out what some of the world's great philosophers, in fact, some of the ancient philosophers had to say, among them the Stoics, about coping with difficult times, such as the times we're in, about how we can be, in fact, happy and peaceful, even in a world that might be somewhat chaotic, posing many challenges for us. Again, my guest back with us, Tom Morris. Tom was for 15 years professor of philosophy at the University of Notre Dame. He's now chairman of the Morris Institute for Human Values at morrisinstitute.com. And among Tom's books, The Stoic Art of Living and The Art of Achievement. If you'd like to join a conversation, 614-292-8513. You can email comments or questions to openline at wosu.org. Back to our phones, and our caller is Dennis. Hello, Dennis.
Hi, how are you today?
Good.
Hey, you know, there's so many things running around in my head right now, and you talked about overcoming challenges and bad times. I found out when I was 1980, I was going blind. I was 27 years old.
Wow.
And I didn't realize that, I couldn't see it dark in at night, but I just thought that when you turn the lights off, you just don't see. Mm-hmm. So I didn't know that I had any kind of eye disease until I went to an ophthalmologist, and he predicted that I would be going blind in 5 or 6 years. And so I had to kind of deal with that and take that challenge on. And I went to a big company, IBM, thought I would, spend the rest of my years there. And then when I was in my mid-40s, I got laid off from, downsized or whatever. And so there was a point in my life where, I was going to the unemployment line. Here this blind guy with, I was on crutches at the time, I'd gotten run over, and it was pretty low time in my life. But, I continued to focus and just think on the other side and point to the other side. And my job was to get a job.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got up in the morning, I'd get on the computer and I'd write my resume or I'd study some additional things and kept on focusing. And now I am blind. I'm a manager, an IT manager at a large electric company here in Columbus. And I also have taken on wood turning, which people have told me that I can't do that either.
Wow.
So that's
incredible. How do you look back now, Dennis, at those roughest times that you went through in the past? How do you view them from your perspective now?
Well, I just, like you're saying, situations happen in your life, and how you deal with them is the way that to get through them. If I felt like I just, as down as I was, and depressed as I was at times, I just thought, a situation happens and you can react to it in different ways.
Right.
And if you don't react to it in a positive way, if you're down and complaining all the time, nobody wants to be around you.
Right.
So it's like, if you're not going to pick yourself up, who's going to do it for you?
That's right. Yeah, and you could make your situation even worse as you alienate the people who would otherwise be there to help you.
Absolutely. So if it looks like you're willing to lend a hand and pick yourself up, then other people are there around you wanting to help along. But if you're not willing to help yourself, why should somebody else want to?
Absolutely. I mean, this is such an important I'm so glad you called, Dennis, because you've been really embodying the wisdom of the great philosophers. transfers. We were saying just a few minutes ago, when difficult things happen, there's an art of self-control, and it consists in three things, basically. Don't rush to judgment, value the right things, and use your imagination well. And now your story has brought up the second art. I call it the art of positive action. It says govern your attitudes, look for opportunities, and take initiative. And that sounds like exactly what you did. You said, okay, I've got a new job now. This is looking for a job. And you weren't going to let the problems you had been through hold you back. You were going to find whatever opportunity you could and take the initiative to make that lead to something good.
Dennis, was that hard work at the time when you were told that you would go blind and you realized that this was not going to be the easiest thing in the world? Did you have to really work on your attitudes? Was there a time when you felt despairing or angry and you worked your way out?
Yeah, you know, there was a point when it was initially told to me, it wasn't real to me. It was just, well, I'm okay. I walked in the eye doctor's office and I could see, and I walked out and I could see. So nothing had changed for me. But eventually, when I had to stop driving, you know, there's a lot of people out on the roads that should not be driving because they just can't give up.
Wow.
Being on the road, and I ran through a stop sign, and the car left the ground, and I thought, that's it, I can't do this anymore. At that point, you know, I had one of those crying moments, and an acceptance moment, and I ended up going to a therapist for a while, just kind of talking through things, and eventually I kind of worked my way out. But it was tough, the acceptance, the whole list of those things that you do go through with grieving.
It would have to, yeah. There is a grieving process, right? Yeah. Surely.
Absolutely.
Well, Dennis, thank you for sharing all that with us. That's great.
No problem. Thanks for your show.
Great. Thank you. Bye-bye. And, Dennis is a fine example of all the things you've just been talking about, choosing
Absolutely.
Our thoughts, discipline of desire, and a very tough process. And as Dennis said, difficult and painful at times, but nonetheless, wow, what a job you did.
That's so important, Fred, the point you just made. When we isolate ideas from the great philosophers, like don't rush to judgment and govern your attitudes, look for opportunities, it can make it all sound so easy, you know, as if there's this simple checklist. Well, you know, as a matter of fact, there is a simple checklist, but it doesn't mean it's easy to implement. And you could go through a lot of turmoil, inner turmoil and struggle in your attempt to do this right, in your attempt to respond properly to a challenging situation. But at least there is, you know, light at the end of the tunnel. There is hope. There have been found to be principles in human nature that you can bring into a situation and eventually prevail.
Mm-hmm. At 614-292-8513, we have a second Dennis with us. Hello, Dennis.
Hi, how are you today?
Good.
Common question, I'm sure. I was just watching Alexander as a movie about Alexander the Great, and I was stunned by the emphasis on lack of fear and courage. Mm-hmm. And I'm under the complete impression now that our society is so complicated. We got so many things that we have to balance and try to do, that I think that we have almost an innate fear right now that keeps us from being retrospective and contemplative like the ancients. I mean, I can imagine them, they talk about Alexander going east, and he said there were people that would stare at nothing for hours.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it sounds like they're not doing anything, and I think we're so busy we don't have time to implement the kind of positive thinking that he's talking about, the kind of things that yoga does, or maybe even hypnosis. Mm-hmm. These are almost taboos in the right wing, I mean, of religious right wing thinking.
Mm-hmm.
These are negative aspects of human thinking and not positive.
Mm-hmm.
That idea of busyness, Thomas Merton once said that he thought busyness, excessive busyness, was a form of violence. And I had to think about that a little bit, but then I realized, yeah, it kind of is toward ourselves in the sense that Dennis is saying, if you don't have a certain amount of time to do these things, you got a problem.
Yeah, we become, and pretty soon it's like we're on a raft being rushed down a fast-moving river with no steering, with no paddle of our own. And Seneca said, isn't it a shame to ever find yourself in the place where you say, how did I get here? We have to make time for the important things. I mean, Socrates once said, the least important things we think about and talk about the most important things we think about and talk about the least. We should turn that around. And I wish it were more widely understood that we need to give ourselves the gift of time. It's truly the most precious thing we have. And we allow too many unnecessary situations dictate how our time will be used. And we shouldn't be surprised that we end up in places that we can't understand how in the world we got there.
Sure.
We need to take control of our time a little more, because only that will allow us to take control of our lives a little
more. Hey, Tom?
Yeah.
I was trying to jot down some things. I got some old books written in the 50s. Have you ever heard the Territorial Imperative? Have you ever read that book or heard of it?
I've heard of it. I haven't read it.
Well, let me tell you, if you can get a copy of it, I got two copies because I was so impressed. And this guy was an anthropologist way back, but at one point back in the 40s, I guess they thought they'd discovered everything.
Uh-huh.
He became a writer.
Mm-hmm.
Wrote plays, which is basically modern anthropology, if you want, or whatever. At any rate, he had a friend that told him, you need to get back into this, and we got some new ways of rediscovering new things. Well, he got back into it, and he began to talk about arena sports. And he said how we organize our thinking, our subconscious, around battles and around conflict, and that we turn it into a sport so we can view it when we're not actually doing it.
Right.
And I was thinking about, who was the emperor around 163? What was his name? He was a Stoic. Justin the Martyr. Have you ever heard of Justin the
Martyr?
Oh, sure,
yeah.
Well, I was so impressed with what I was reading there, and I can't remember that emperor's name. Do you remember his name?
Oh, so you're not talking about Marcus. You're talking about
Marcus Aurelius.
Oh, Marcus, yeah.
And, you know, anybody that can read that and read his memoirs to himself.
Oh, yeah, his meditation, sure.
And that's just amazing. There's so much that we need to expose ourselves that in the past.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right.
Nietzsche. I've got a book called The Portable Nietzsche, and a lot of his stuff was wrongly interpreted.
Right.
Because they said the Superman, he was actually talking about underman, being controlling oneself. You know, actually, it's almost like the concept of defeating, you know, the monster within.
Right. Yeah.
That's right. And we used the word transcending a little bit earlier. Nietzsche believed that it was time for us to transcend or rise above so much that had governed our behavior in the past, that greater things were possible for us.
Dennis, thank you for your thoughts today. Tom Morris with us, chairman of the Morris Institute for Human Values at morrisinstitute.com. Among Tom's books, The Stoic Art of Living and The Art of Achievement. Tom, you were writing about Socrates at morrisinstitute.com, and you talked about Socrates anchoring. We, like Socrates, can anchor ourselves to the ultimate spiritual supports available to any of us, what are some of those supports? Have we been talking about some of them in this past hour?
Yeah, we have. And as a matter of fact, I did for on Huffington Post last week, I did an essay. I was able to use the title of one of my books of the past because it's relevant in a new way now. The title is If Aristotle Ran General Motors. And I talked about in that essay truth, beauty, goodness, and unity, the intellectual, aesthetic, moral, and spiritual domains of life, and their ultimate foundations, their ultimate targets and foundations, truth, beauty, goodness, and unity. With Socrates, you had him always trying to uncover a deeper sense of those things. What is truth? What is beauty? What is goodness? What is unity? You have that bequeathed from the example of Socrates through Plato, through Aristotle, through so many of the other ancient thinkers. They were digging for those spiritual foundations that will allow us a kind of a firm anchorage in the world. It's almost like when we have a hurricane here in Wilmington, North Carolina. What are you going to hold on to when the wind blows really, really hard? That's what some of the more practical philosophers were looking for. What can we really hold on to when the winds of change blow hard at us? And it was things like truth, beauty, goodness, unity. really grasping onto these things and understanding how they are to be applied in our lives, then we're not so shaken by those vicissitudes, those changes, that turbulence every day that comes our way.
What did they mean by unity?
A kind of a connectedness, a kind of a sense of, well, the opposite of alienation. You know, when you go into a workplace, for example, or when you go to a country where alienation prevails, very little of good gets accomplished. It's not a recipe for success. When people feel connected, when they feel internal unity, first of all, let's start at the most basic level, harmony within themselves. We were just talking about your thoughts, your desires, your actions. If we can have an internal unity so that we're not acting at cross purposes with ourselves, so that we're not nurturing emotions contrary to the beliefs that we have, so that we are one person, we have inner consistency and unity, that makes us stronger, and that makes us able to enter into relationships, whether family or community relationships, with a degree of unity or strength. And you can see how that cascades out. The philosophers at their best have understood unity not as conformity, not as homogeneity, not anything like that, but how we link together in a positive way with others. And we can only do that when we have the unity going on in ourselves to start with.
Mm-hmm. How did they see beauty as one of the anchors for a life?
Well, you know, Plato saw the good as the highest in reality, that everyone is ultimately motivated by their own vision of the good. What do you imagine? What do you envision as the good? That will motivate you. That will lure you. That will draw you forward. He also believed that the beauty in the world is the path of the good. What we see as beautiful will be the way the good appears to us. So it's funny, Fred, because we have, you know, modern concepts of beauty. You think right away of, you know, magazine cover models or maybe a beautiful landscape. Or throughout human history, there's been a much more complex and multidimensional understanding of beauty. Mathematicians will talk about a beautiful formula. People will talk about a beautiful solution to a problem, you know, and we know, and, you know, in basketball, it could be a beautiful move to the basket. Your concept of beauty is tied to your concept of good. And if indeed Plato was right, that the good motivates us more deeply than anything else, and if he was right, that the beautiful, what we consider beautiful, is linked to our understanding of the good, then our pursuit of beauty in our lives is going to be very important.
At 614-292-8513, we're with Chris. Hi, Chris.
Hello. One thing that is a barrier is to implementing some of the ideas that have been talked about today is just the first glimpse into those ideas, that sometimes people are beaten so far down mm-hmm. that they can't do anything other than survive at some base level. And
right.
So the challenge that we face, I think, as a society, is how to help those, including ourselves, who are beaten down, to have them at least look that there is a better life possible. And
sure.
And how, and your thoughts on to how to reach those people to help them understand that, how to help them take that first step toward a more full life.
This is a very good question, Chris. I've come to believe in my years and now decades of being a philosopher, I've come to believe that life is supposed to be a series of adventures. Adventures are always transitions from the known into the unknown. The unknown always evokes fear and difficulties, and often adventures break us down before they build us up. So some people, things have to get so bad in their lives, and we have expressions like hitting bottom, where suddenly they become open to ideas and new ways of dealing with things that they had been closed to before. So sometimes the best thing that can happen to a person is that the worst thing happened to them, because that's going to crack the shell. That's going to open them up to greater wisdom, to a different approach to life. For those who haven't yet gotten to that point, well, I love the old saying, repair the roof while the sun is still shining. You know, if we if we understand this wisdom and if we're taught it early enough in life, we can begin to cultivate the habits of proper response before those huge storms enter into our lives. You know, we can get that roof nice and solid before the hurricane is actually impending and bearing down on us. But I think if people can be see, this is one of the great shames of the last 100 years. We've had people used to read the practical philosophers 100 years ago. Then philosophy wanted to model itself on the sciences, and it got really esoteric, really abstruse, very technical. People weren't reading the Stoics anymore. People weren't reading some of the practical philosophers anymore. And now, in our economic difficulties, people are saying, well, we're going to have to cut the humanities because, of course, that's not really necessary. I think the humanities, the wisdom, the accumulated wisdom of the past is what we most need to be grounding ourselves in just to prepare ourselves for these difficult times and to give us some wisdom we need for moving forward in a positive way.
Mm-hmm. Chris, a few thoughts from you, and then we're going to move on. Chris, are you there?
Thank you. Bye.
Oh, okay, no more from Chris. And, of course, Chris makes the point that if somebody is so beaten down, if they are, in fact, let's say, clinically depressed, you know, they're going to need some help.
That's right.
But beyond that, Tom, I like your idea of as you say, well, the sun shines, you know, you cultivate these attitudes of mind and desire and action that do you well when something really awful or really difficult comes into your life. Yeah, absolutely.
That's right. And we don't want to say for a minute that philosophy can do this alone. You're right. Sometimes people need, you know, chemical intervention. They need medical intervention for certain problems of depression that have arisen in connection possibly with external events. So in the modern world, we wouldn't say, you don't need medicine, you just need wisdom. But what you need is, but you always need wisdom.
What did the ancient philosophers say about coping with the negative in the world? Now, we may be more aware of negativity because of our mass media. We see these terrible wars going on all across the world, and you pick up the paper, you know, you listen to the radio, you've got a million horrible situations that we can learn about. And that can tend to have an effect in one's life. So what did the philosophers say about dealing with that?
Well, you know, it's funny because we've had a lot of people throughout history stress the importance of our imaginations. It's widely reported that people fear, you know, air travel much more than they fear driving to the grocery store, and yet their chances of dying in an accident are much higher driving to the grocery store than getting on an airplane and flying across the world. Our fears and sometimes our negative attitudes aren't as tied to reality as we typically think they are. The imagination intervenes. You know, Einstein once said, imagination is everything. I love it that we have a nugget from Chaucer. People can die of mere imagination.
Hmm.
You know, again, it's what we focus on. Some people are better off of avoiding negative news because they have not learned to transcend. They have not learned to control their imaginations. But I think, you know, we're better off if we're better informed overall. So to prepare ourselves to be able to deal with all the reports we have on all the troubles of the world day to day, we need to cultivate this inner resilience. We need to cultivate this inner spirit that's not so easily overturned. Because human beings have withstood terrible things in the past, and we can now. I mean, we're as worried as I've seen folks in the past 6 months, and I deal with a lot of companies in the financial sector, as worried as I've seen people, it's nothing like the barbarians sacking Rome. I mean, human beings have been through much worse situations, and they've gotten through those situations using the wisdom they had available. We have that same wisdom available to us. Mm-hmm. We can survive as well.
You make a good point, Tom. It is what you focus on. I talked with a woman who worked in conflict zones, in mm-hmm. zones of civil warfare, went to those areas, to villages in developing countries, and tried to help make things better.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, how do you stay positive in a situation like this where you've got really people just slaughtering one another?
Oh, yeah.
And she said, you know, when you go into these conflict zones, she said, the vast majority of the people don't want this to happen. She said, you go to the people in the villages, for the most part, in most situations, they're not interested in this going on. They just, like us, they want to lead peaceful lives, but
right.
certain groups among them have gotten a hold of armaments and are clashing. So she said that the people I work with are the people who don't want this to be happening, to see if there are ways we can ameliorate the conflict. One of the things she talked about was when in one village, when some of their sons came back from the warfare from some of these armed gangs, the mothers in the village literally kidnapped them and deprogrammed them.
Right?
And yeah, they took them in and they said, "Look, these are not the values we taught you as our sons, and you're going to stay here until we de-brainwash you," essentially. And that had some success. So it is what you focus on, I guess.
You know, and your exact example shows something else too. Here you're talking to this lady who lived and worked in perhaps some of the most dangerous places in the world. I know people who think that New York City is too dangerous to visit. Oh, well, wait a minute. You know, there are plenty of people who live in New York City every day. Again, it's about imagination. It's about what we focus on. You know, I talk to people all the time. I have a good friend in radio whose wife has been covering all the hot spots in the Middle East, all the war zones for 10 years now, and she's just fine. I mean, we have to learn not to let our imaginations get out of control.
Absolutely. Back to our phones, and hello, Sylvia. You're on the air.
Oh, yes. Thank you, Fred. I'm just thrilled with these high-minded subjects and your guest. I wanted to comment on how you opened the program with how we view failure in this society. I think that our greatest athletes are probably the best at failure.
Mm-hmm.
I know Michael Jordan says he probably missed more shots than anyone else playing basketball, and Babe Ruth struck out more than any other baseball player.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we try to teach our kids that they dare not fail, so we take them out of the arena of competition and try to build their egos and their self-esteem, and we lose that wonderful component of failure.
That's very wise, Sylvia. That's very wise. Using the example of Michael Jordan, I live in his hometown of Wilmington, North Carolina, where he was kicked off the high school basketball team for not being good enough. Now, this is the local Wilmington high school basketball team. And you can imagine, as a young man playing a competitive sport like basketball, he was probably distraught when this news came his way. Not only had he missed a shot, he was kicked off the team.
That's
he
amazing.
Didn't make the next year's team, and yet look what he went on to do.
Yeah.
It's all in how we deal with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there are uses for failure, Tom, depending on, again, how we approach it, what we think about it, what
That's
we
right.
tell ourselves about
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. Failure can be the greatest learning experience imaginable.
Yeah.
I mean,
right.
you have to learn how not to do things in order to know how to do things. The Talmud actually has an expression like this. Unless you've already understood something wrong quite a few times, you'll never understand it right. And failure is part of the learning curve. And you're right, absolutely right, Sylvia. We've made people petrified of failure by exalting the concept of success too much.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Sylvia.
Bye.
Tom, also, we have a couple of minutes left here from at MorrisInstitute.com. One of your essays, you talked about Tom Wolfe's novel from a few years back, A Man in Full, the main character, Charlie, who'd been this very rich fellow. And at one point, Charlie gives and had been brought to his knees, and at one point, economically, at one point, Charlie gave a philosophical sermon in which he says, What is it you're looking for in this endless quest, even for material goods? He says, you're looking for tranquility. You think if only you can acquire enough worldly goods, enough recognition, enough eminence, you'll be free. There'll be nothing more to worry about. And instead, you become a bigger and bigger slave to how you think others are judging you.
Yeah. Isn't that something? That's such a common story, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we should judge ourselves by the right standards, not by the standards we think other people have.
Yeah.
And that's one of the liberating things of Stoic philosophy. In fact, Tom Wolfe, more than anybody else, has brought attention through that book to the great Stoic philosophers because he had Epictetus play such a role in that book. Epictetus's wisdom about liberation. Epictetus, who had been a slave and was a freed man, became a philosopher and really became the philosopher of liberation. We should liberate ourselves from illusions, from unhealthy emotions, from unhealthy expectations and wrong standards. Then you can live a good life.
Sure. And just to conclude, you quote the Stoic philosopher Seneca, once said, would you rather have much or enough?
I love that.
Well, Tom, it's been a great pleasure working with you all these years, and I know our paths will cross in the future. And
Fred,
I'm delighted
I've never had as much fun with a radio host in anywhere in America, and to do this again with you, I'll probably just have to get my own radio show.
Again. We'll work together again in one form or another, I'm sure.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, Tom Morris again. You can read Tom's essays at morrisinstitute.com and on Huffington Post, and among Tom's books, The Stoic Art of Living and The Art of Achievement. When we come back after the news, progressive activist Norman Solomon with us. He says, why is America still at war? He asked that question on listener-supported WOSU, WOSU HD 820 Columbus, streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820 NPR News.